Los filtrados sugieren que la llamada rebelión iraquí está siendo dirigida desde el cuartel de la Central de Inteligencia Norteamericana y centros de comando del Pentágono. Luego está el apoyo financiero a ISIS proveído por los grandes aliados de Washington, Kuwait, Qatar y Arabia Saudita. Engdahl añade que miembros clave de ISIS fueron entrenados en 2012 por la CIA y comandos de fuerzas especiales norteamericanas en un campo secreto de Jordania. El escritor señala que fuentes fidedignas jordanas revelan que los servicios de inteligencia de Estados Unidos, Turquía y Jordania estaban a cargo de Safawi, un campo de entrenamiento jordano en el norte del país. El lugar está convenientemente ubicado cerca de la frontera de Siria e Irak. El entrenamiento de ISIS en Jordania, dice Engdahl, fue financiado por Arabia Saudita y Qatar, dos monarquías del Golfo que pagaban por la guerra contra el presidente Bashar al-Assad de Siria. Las aclaraciones de Washington de que ellos no entrenan yihadistas es una broma, acota Engdahl. ¿Acaso existe un ADN yihadista que han descubierto los actores de la Central de Inteligencia? Andrew Doran, exoficial del Departamento de Estado norteamericano, escribiendo para la revista National Review, anota que guerrilleros del ISIS poseen pasaportes de los Estados Unidos. Luego está la presencia de Takhan Batirashvili, yihadista checheno, considerado el cerebro de las victorias militares de ISIS en los últimos días. En Los Ángeles, yo soy Fernando Velázquez.
El gobierno argentino declaró el miércoles que respeta sus compromisos internacionales y está dispuesto a pagar su deuda, pero el reciente fallo de la Suprema Corte de Estados Unidos pone en peligro no solo el cumplimiento de dichas obligaciones, sino la economía del país.
Así lo afirmó hoy ante el grupo de los 77 más China el ministro de Economía argentino, Axel Kicillof, quien expuso la situación de su país ante el fallo del pasado 16 de junio, según el cual Argentina debería pagar casi 1.500 millones de dólares a los fondos buitres para el 30 de este mes. Ese dictamen paraliza el proceso de reestructuración y coloca a Argentina en una situación de incumplimiento técnico, explicó Kicillof.
La Argentina quiere seguir pagando, pero no la dejan. Es un caso inédito, insólito, porque nos han impuesto determinadas condiciones que, como verán, tienen consecuencias que ponen en riesgo no ya la reestructuración, no ya la situación financiera externa del país, sino la economía en su conjunto. Quiere decir que el accionar de los fondos buitres no es que pone en riesgo la reestructuración, pone en riesgo al país, pone en riesgo a nuestro pueblo, pone en riesgo los derechos para proteger a los argentinos del accionar del sistema financiero internacional.
Kicillof señaló que Argentina y advirtió que de cumplirse el fallo, otros países podrían sufrir una situación similar, puesto que se crearía un precedente. Subrayó además que si el fallo se implementa, todos los acreedores que habían aceptado la reestructuración podrían reclamar las mismas condiciones, lo que llevaría a Argentina a la quiebra. El ministro repasó la historia del endeudamiento externo de su país, que se acrecentó de manera alarmante a partir de 1976 con la dictadura militar y terminó en 2001 con la peor de las crisis sociales del país. Recordó que desde 2003 Argentina inició un programa de reestructuración aceptado por más del 90% de los acreedores. Sin embargo, los fondos buitres compraron bonos no reestructurados de una minoría y demandaron al país para que pagara el valor nominal más una serie de intereses y penalidades acumuladas que a la fecha suman 1.500 millones de dólares.
Un 1% pone en riesgo lo que voluntariamente aceptó prácticamente la unanimidad de los demás bonistas. Muchas gracias.
Era Axel Kicillof, ministro de Economía de Argentina, hablando ante el G77 más China en la sede de la ONU. Carla García, Naciones Unidas, Nueva York.
Entrevistado por la prensa, el ministro de Economía de Argentina recalcó que los fondos buitre que compraron bonos basura de la deuda argentina se negaron a reestructurar los pagos como si lo hizo el 92% de los acreedores. Los fondos buitre exigen a la Argentina un pago del 1.600% de ganancias de su inversión original.
El gobierno argentino del que yo formo parte no es el que tomó la deuda. Por supuesto que hay una continuidad jurídica del Estado, pero no es el gobierno el que tomó la deuda, sino que cuando se tomó esa deuda que resultó impagable, hubo apoyo de muchísimos organismos financieros internacionales para decir que no iba a haber ningún problema. Tampoco es este gobierno el que fue al default, sino que es el gobierno que reestructuró con un 93% de aceptación todos estos pasivos y que pagó absolutamente todos sus compromisos por montos que superan los 190 mil millones de dólares. Y ahora lo que encontramos es que hay riesgo de que por pagar, tal como dice el fallo de Griesa, a los bonistas que han actuado, y a los fondos buitre, y los llamo buitre porque han comprado los títulos a precio vil para obtener ganancia de 1.600%, y que nunca han querido negociar, porque si no hubieran ido a la reestructuración o a todas las rondas de consulta que se produjeron antes de llegar a esa reestructuración. La reestructuración fue exitosa porque la precedió una negociación. Argentina sí negocia, negocia de buena fe y paga, y quiere pagar, pero no la dejan.
El video con la presentación completa de Kicillof ante la ONU puede ser visto en nuestra página blog en pueblossinfronteras.wordpress.com. En Venezuela, jóvenes de la calle y expandilleros se organizan para labrarse un futuro mejor junto a sus comunidades. Karen Méndez, de Noticias RT, habló con un grupo de ellos.
Eliud pasó su niñez y su adolescencia en la calle. Era uno de esos que deambulaban por Caracas atrapados en las drogas. Los conocidos niños huele pega. Tenía 6 años cuando se escapó de su casa y más nunca supo cómo volver.
Buenos días, hermano, buenos días.
Hace poco más de un año, Eliud creó la Hermandad, un frente que agrupa a líderes comunitarios, obreros y jóvenes que decidieron abandonar las armas para recuperar espacios de la ciudad y convertirlos en espacios de paz.
Nosotros queremos contribuir a lo que es la transformación del ser humano. Sabes, que la gente sienta lo que es el gentilicio venezolano, que sepa que no podemos matarnos entre hermanos, pues.
El mensaje de la hermandad se fue regando por varios populosos barrios de la capital, y muchos de aquellos jóvenes que antes delinquían ahora son luchadores sociales, respetados y aceptados tal y como son. Hoy ya suman más de 400 personas.
Yo deseo que todos los chamos que están en los barrios, las comunidades, entre los niños y los adolescentes, incluso ya señores mayores que tienen mala conducta, que le bajen toda la violencia, pues, porque es mejor vivir aquí y vivir feliz que estar dentro de una prisión.
Charles es otro de los integrantes de la hermandad. Empezó a consumir drogas y a delinquir a los 9 años. Creció viendo a su madre prostituirse y vendiendo narcóticos para mantenerlo a él y a sus 8 hermanos.
Por lo menos esta cara se le ve que ha pasado bastante hambre y he sufrido bastante. Tú sabes que una vez le dije yo a mi mamá, cuando yo estaba muchacho, yo le dije, mire mamá, yo no quiero que tú trabajes, porque mi mamá era tan bonita, yo le dije, mamá, yo no quiero que tú trabajes, la responsabilidad de la casa la asumo yo. Yo no quiero que tú trabajes, yo voy a vender droga, le dije, yo voy a vender droga porque yo no quiero que tú te expresas.
El drama familiar de Charles se repite en miles de hogares venezolanos. Para algunos analistas, el fácil acceso a las drogas, la desarticulación familiar y también la impunidad ha creado una especie de subcultura delincuencial que ha hecho que niños y adolescentes sean captados por bandas criminales.
La mayor parte de los que asesinan y los que mueren en Venezuela son jóvenes de entre 13 y 25 años de edad, una situación que ha despertado la preocupación de todo el país. Sin embargo, desde el sector juvenil se han emprendido proyectos para hacerle frente a este flagelo que tanto ha enlutado a las familias venezolanas.
Petare es uno de los barrios más violentos de Venezuela y de América Latina. Aquí funciona una de las escuelas de Barrio TV, un proyecto que lleva de manera gratuita a los jóvenes del país herramientas comunicacionales que les permitan encontrar alternativas ante la violencia.
Es el tiempo de los intentos. Barrio TV es una de esas, a que suelten la pistola y bueno, inténtenlo en una escuela de televisión. Hasta ahorita hay 11 escuelas repartidas en 11 barrios de Caracas, sus 11 antenas, sus 11 escuelas, para que ellos mismos rellenen su programación con sus rostros y sus necesidades, lo que quieran contar, sus denuncias, lo que sea.
El reto que tiene tanto el gobierno como toda la sociedad venezolana es que estos niños que han sido rescatados no caigan en manos de la delincuencia y recuperar a quienes aún están en el otro camino. Un desafío que, de lograrse, permitirá que Venezuela empiece a transitar hacia una vida lejos de la violencia. Karen Méndez, RT, Caracas.
Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. A nombre de Fanele Millán y del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención.
You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert, and this is Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides coming next at you. It's the June 26th. I think we're June 26th show, or is it the 27th? Anyway, it's somewhere around there. It's Thursday. And so stay tuned. You're going to be, who knows, perhaps favorably surprised.
Genocide, where is home?
Yeah, And that was, of course, Land by Five. Welcome to Bathrop's Piers Broadsides. Two more hours of me talking at you, unless you decide you want to talk at me. And you can by calling in. 831-427-3772 is the call-in. And so consider it, because it gives variety to the show. And so, I'm going to begin with a little music and then a few flashbacks. And unfortunately, my guest today, Steve Plaich, for the third time has canceled. This time, apparently, his explanation is he has laryngitis because of an all-night round delay with suicide prevention. That's the latest. And he has pinky finger promised to come in on Sunday at 11, at which point he will be facing the redoubtable Pat Colby, or Punch Him Out Pat, as I've sometimes called her, who's and I'm actually going to we may even hear from Pat later in the show if she behaves herself. And from you, 427-3772, if you want to be part of a conversation. Again, what we usually talk about on the air is sort of a ongoing litany of concern about civil rights violations in Santa Cruz, trying to be as specific as we can and as updated as we can so that it doesn't become intensely boring and repetitious. Unfortunately, that actually seems to be a necessity to some extent, because the same things repeat themselves in what may seem a boring cycle, although it's not boring to those it happens to. It's uncomfortable, gruesome, unpleasant, costly, and abusive. At least that's been my view. So I'm going to begin. What I want to do is I want to review what happened at the last city council meeting. There were some nasty things that got passed, of course, and some voices did speak up. Pat here in the studio is one of them, and there are a number of other people who spoke up. I was surprised. Pat prepared quite a presentation for 5 minutes around the presence of commercial freestanding sidewalk signs that you'll find advertising the different businesses up and down Pacific Avenue. And I found, through simply asking, I guess, the guy who's the main planner in the department, whether these signs had permits, I learned that there's no permits possible for freestanding signs on Pacific Avenue. They are simply legally banned, which may be ridiculous. I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with somebody putting a sign out for a period of time, provided they don't block the sidewalk forever or create a real problem, though some have suggested there could be problems for people with disabilities. But the real problem seems to be the discriminatory both enforcement and attitude towards who has the right to be on the sidewalk and whom the sidewalks really belong to. Now, I've always said the sidewalks belong to the community, everyone, merchants, even visitors have a say. They have the right to be on the public sidewalks, even if the merchants don't like them there, even if the city fathers decide they're the wrong kind of people, even if they don't speak English, you know, all that sort of thing. And, of course, poor people as well as rich people have the right to use the sidewalks, or should. They don't, actually, in Santa Cruz, and that's one of the problems. So the situation is, how is it that you can see so many signs up and down Pacific Avenue sitting there, and they're all illegal? And then when you ask the man who's responsible for handling complaints about this, he will tell you that there have been no complaints about those signs and no compliance actions taken around those signs, at least for the last year. And it's not that I want to set in motion a sort of, you know, put your sign away or we're going to give you a ticket, necessarily, process. But people are getting citations right and left for simply putting their butts down on the sidewalk or sitting at a little table trying to sell scarves or pass on their handiwork for donation or show their artwork or have a little sign that says, need help, and a little cup in front of them, or play their music for donation. And this, of course, became notorious when the great Morgani, who's an accordion player that I have some differences of opinion with, but he's quite a colorful fellow, he was finally told that he would have to obey the rules, which essentially drove him out of town and showing that the rules are ridiculous, both in terms of how they treat everybody and poor people and non-Morgani, non-famous people, but also even Morgani, the rule that says you can't be within 14 feet of a building. If you are busking, if you are playing for a donation, or performing for a donation, or sitting, or spare changing, or having a political table, all these things. And so this created some hubbub, and there was a response by two council members, Pamela Comstock and Don Lane, who's the vice mayor, in order to quell the hubbub, which initially resulted in some protests. We were out on the sidewalks, getting people to sign petitions, encouraging people to set up their displays, which they did in violation of the ordinances, but not in violation of public safety and health, and not in violation of the right to walk on the sidewalk, and not in violation of any reasonable common sense interpretation of how public space can reasonably be shared. And no tickets were ever issued to us during our protest. I think we came out four or five times on different weeks, different Wednesdays, different Saturdays, different Sundays. And we got a little bit of hassle from the police who were telling us, don't block this and don't block that. And I had to tell the police officer, we're not blocking anything. Please leave us alone. And they stood around in groups of five and then in groups of two watching and so forth. But, you know, the problem is that there were some people that got harassed. And one of the people that got harassed is a woman named Kate Wenzel, who you've heard on this show before. And Kate was one of the people who spoke at City Council yesterday. Pat originally kind of asked her if she'd come down to help because Pat's presentation ran 5 minutes at Oral Communications where she essentially showed, and you can't really see it, of course, on the radio, but you can imagine. She did a PowerPoint presentation, which may be later posted online. I'm not sure. Pat, maybe you're doing that. She's nodding. It showed how there was sign after sign violating the sign ordinance. And yet, no enforcement was being taken, yet people were being harassed. I don't think that was shown as clearly in the presentation on Tuesday, but it certainly has been the case. And what the police have done, well, I'm jumping ahead. Pamela and Don, these two council members, were kind of proposed that there be little chalked or painted areas where people could be that would be would allow them to be even next to buildings occasionally, which has been a forbidden no-no for 20 years. Why, you might ask? Because the city can't think of any other way to drive poor and homeless people and groups of undesirables out of town or away. And they instead, you know, created increasingly encroaching forbidden zones, which are, they measure from buildings. From cross, from intersections, from benches, from telephones, from directory signs, from trash cans, from sidewalk cafes, from kiosks. And in other words, it really leaves a fractional amount of sidewalk left for people to use in the traditional way that Santa Cruz, certainly counterculture people have used it, but also other people, just people who want to, tourists who want to stop and sit down and relax on a warm day, put their butts next to a building, and not, assuming they're not blocking the door or anything. But it's illegal to do that even with a vacant building, even a closed building. A fence where there's no building at all, it's also illegal. It's illegal to do it near a bench. It's become illegal. And this, of course, is not enforced with any regularity or any consistency, but has become the basis for selective enforcement. And Kate Wenzel, who sells scarves on Pacific Avenue, talks about this and talked about it at the city council meeting on Tuesday. What I'm going to begin by playing, though, I think was one of the first interviews I ever had with her back in November. And I don't think I ever had a chance to play it. And actually, she was very optimistic, and she hadn't gotten harassment at that point. This was, I think, before the arrival of the infamous Officer Barnett, a CSO who took a special interest in Kate Wenzel, of a rather unhealthy sort, in my view, and began harassing her, ticketing her, demanding she move every hour. And for the first time, he and other officers began, particularly him, though, asking for business licenses on Pacific Avenue to engage in relatively low-profile selling of crafts that the people themselves had made. So, let's listen to this interview. And I'm also going to set up the mics for Pat. And also in the studio with me is the ever-slumbering Michael O'Grady, who, since it's illegal to sleep after 11, apparently seems to be wanting to sleep before 11. Catches a little rest where he can. Actually, Michael's lucky he's in the... Perhaps he's lucky. He's in the Pauley Loft, the Homeless Lack of Services Centers. Get on the waiting list, and some months later you can get into the program. And he's often talked about that on the air, the problems and the advantages of being there. Anyway, we're going to hear more, though, about this council meeting. And first, let's hear about Kate's experience with the authorities downtown, her experience with Santa Cruz as of November, when she, I think, had just arrived in town. I could be wrong about that, but this was certainly one of the early interviews. So it is November. I am. Huh. November 22nd here, about 2:45. I'm talking with
Kate Wenzel.
And Kate, you're doing some knitting, it looks like. You have a variety of nice-looking, colorful yarns here as you sit in front of, what is this? Sway, thank you. And you, of course, are, you're just doing some knitting. It doesn't look, it's a display device. So therefore, you are technically sitting on public property. You're violating at least two ordinances. Have the police given you any hassles here?
The hospitality people come around all day long and let me know if I'm doing something wrong. They've been pretty lenient with me. The thing they seem to focus on the most is being 14 feet from a bunch of different things.
14 feet from a crosswalk,
mm-hmm.
14
and,
feet from a building.
Yeah, and then not displaying on public property. Every once in a while, police will come and tell me, I don't even know if it's police or security, but they'll let me know that I'm this or that, or how long have I been here. A couple times I got that.
I'm going to be interrupting occasionally. It's perfectly legal to display things on public property, except you have to have your own display device, and it can't be a blanket. This is part of the issue that Pat Colby raised, initially raised by Pamela Comstock, who referred to, and it was not too clear, either people downtown or their displays as clutter. And this was sort of seconded, I believe, by Mayor Robinson, maybe even by Cynthia Matthews, although, again, I don't have the exact transcript. Pat is nodding, though, and she better have the documentation or we'll be suing her for libel. She's reaching into her bag for her documents, perhaps. But anyway, we'll get into that. The issue became clutter that Pat talked about, and was showing that the real clutter downtown is the series of signs that are actually blocking things that don't involve real human beings, but simply are commercial devices that have usurped the right of the public to freely use the sidewalks. And I again use the word usurp because they're there all day and they serve a private interest for a particular business that already has a damn store there. They already have a big sign. They have a window. You know, they want to steal more of the public space. And in fact, that's really what these ordinances have been about, the ones that are limit people to how they can use the sidewalk, increasingly shortening and shrinking the space that is allowed, because the merchants want to make sure that a raggedy person isn't sitting near their store, because, you see, that might interfere with their business. And no doubt, for some people, that might interfere with their business. For a certain older, more nervous, more apprehensive person who is used to a different kind of, gated community mentality, yeah, it might have that effect. But the issue is really, what are the rights of the community on the sidewalks? And the rights of the community on the sidewalks are to have them for non-commercial use, provided they're not blocking people. That's been my view. Unfortunately, the courts have taken a more narrow view. They talk about regulations of time, place, and manner for First Amendment activity, and that becomes something that can be used to strangle free speech and has been so used in Santa Cruz. So that's something that I may be discussing. Well, I've always kind of bringing it up and talking about it peripherally. But the issue of clutter, which Pamela Comstock brought up, was one that particularly got Colby's goat here. And she wanted to raise the issue in a very dramatic and fact-heavy way to show the real clutter, which are the signs that are littering the avenue and essentially preempting the public space. And then people being referred to as clutter, which I think is how Pat interpreted the comments of Pamela Comstock. And this was part of the presentation you're going to hear as soon as I finish this interview with Kate Wenzel from about 6 months ago. Anyway, the point and the reason I interrupted this whole discussion that Kate was having with me on the sidewalk in November is that she's correct in saying that the 14-foot setbacks are, you know, part of the forbidden zones that make up, at the time, I thought they made up 95% of the sidewalk. Now I think they make up more like 98% of the sidewalk, if you also include the areas that are covered by signs the merchants have put up, or the sidewalk cafes, seating that is manifest everywhere up and down Pacific Avenue or in many spots. However, being on public property, and perhaps Kate meant this, it's also illegal to put your merchandise directly on the ground. That's on public property. The idea that why this would be illegal is problematic and a curiosity to me, except if you want to use it as a device to run off poor people and artisans who can't afford more expensive indoor venues. Anyway, let's hear some more from Kate way back in November.
And then I just comply, and there's no problem.
So how many hours a day have you been out here today?
I'm usually out, I've been here since 9, and it's almost 3, so...
In this spot, pretty much?
In this spot, yeah.
You've been here for more than an hour, you evil woman.
Well, I don't know. Honestly, only times I heard that were from the police, and I was leaving both times, or I had just moved both times. The hospitality people were usually pretty... Actually, I have an interesting story. The other night it started raining, and I was waiting for a customer to come back, and...
And you sell yarn.
Yeah, I sell scarves and that I make. And so I went into the store and asked if I could sit outside to wait for her to come back.
Here come the hospitality now.
Yeah, I know. So, hi.
Get a job.
Go ahead.
So the lady inside said, sure, because I knew that you need permission to be outside, because otherwise I couldn't sit.
This isn't true. Kate is reciting something. It is an often misconceived belief that somehow the merchant can either give or deny permission from a person being on the public sidewalk in front of their store. They can't. However, there are some stores have ingresses or sort of little patio areas that are under their roof, and those are on their property, and they can, in fact, provide permission for people to be there. So, for example, Dale Williams Jewelers has such an area. Marini's may have a small such area. There aren't many stores that have those kind of alcoves, but some do. And if you do have the permission of the store owner, you can be there anytime you want for as long as you want, because it's private property. But I don't think Kate was talking about that. Again, I'm not sure, because it was so long ago. But and if she was, then, you know, she's accurate. If she wasn't, she's telling us something that a lot of people believe, but it simply isn't the case. Some merchants believe it too, and they get very concerned and upset. At least they used to. I think I was told this at some point when they were, you know, you can't tell someone to move away from in front of your business. And in order to get that power, these laws were created. So a merchant could call and say, "There's someone within 14 feet of my business who is seated." You know, or who has got a display device, or who is spare changing. Those are three indices that make it illegal to be within 14 feet. If you're standing up asking for spare change or with a sign that says need help within 14 feet of a building or 14 feet of a lot of other things downtown too, that's illegal. If you're seated doing nothing within 14 feet of a building and you don't have your own chair, that's illegal. And if you are seated or standing and you have a display device with you, which is anything capable of holding tangible things, a very broad definition, usually applied to tables, caps, and open guitar cases, that is also illegal, currently illegal. And it's actually been illegal for years, but the illegal zone extended recently from 10 feet to 14 feet in September. At 14 foot had always been illegal between for people panhandling or for people sitting, subsequent to 2002, when previously it was 6 feet. We have a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Uncle Robert. I listened to your show, it seems to me that we need to have a move by store owners themselves to start criticizing themselves, because this kind of subhuman behavior that you're talking about they're conducting has got to be challenged, and it should be challenged by store owners themselves. So if you give me a few tips and leads, I'll bend a few ears.
Oh, okay. Well,
okay,
you know.
Thank you, Robert.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah.
And actually, there have been times when we have gone to stores, actually. Most recently, we did the backpack bigotry procession, trying to find out which stores allowed, which cafes actually allowed, and which cafes banned large backpacks. And we found that three did ban them, four at the time we thought, but three did and now still ban them, Starbucks, Coffee Roasting Company, and Lulu Carpenters of the cafes downtown. Initially, the problems were around Cafe Pergolesi. A lot of poor people and travelers came to us and said we're being hassled. They were being kicked out. Even they're coming out and harassing us on the sidewalks and so forth. And we researched that, and I think they may have either changed their policy or things seem to get better there. And I think things got better at other places, too. I think Pete's, which was originally on our list of bad boys and bad girls, became more tolerant, or appeared to become more tolerant, and changed their explicit no backpacks policy, although they claimed they'd never had such a policy, even though that's exactly what they told me when I was in there one Saturday some months ago when we did this march. We've attempted to talk to merchants about these different issues. In fact, back in 1994, when the police rioted and caused one woman to miscarry, another man ribs broken, as they arrested people for sitting on the sidewalk in the first round of the sitting ban struggle, after the city council passed the first no sitting ban, in response to some homeless protests, which were trying to point out that sleeping has got to be allowed somewhere. And there were, I think, one homeless group held a 2-week protest on the sidewalk. It's actually very small. It had two or three people, and it was called, the World Peace Vigil, and it was done around Christmas of 1993. And in response, then-Mayor Neil Coonerty, who is the retiring supervisor now, his son Ryan Coonerty has taken over, pushed for legislation and got it that set up the first sitting ban in Santa Cruz in 1994. And massive protests followed. The police generally kept a low profile and tried to ignore them, hoping they'd go away. And they kind of did, but then the police made a mistake. When Food Not Bombs was serving food, they started arresting people for sitting down or citing them with the idea of driving Food Not Bombs away. And the next week, there were several hundred people who came down, and 40 of whom got arrested for sitting, and the police had to stop arresting because more people came and just sat down to take the place of those who were arrested. It was a very gratifying and refreshing civil rights exercise. A month or two later, all the citations were thrown out by the courts. You would have thought that that would be that, but the mayor appealed the law. It was then Mayor Scott Kennedy, otherwise liberal in terms of his opinions regarding wars abroad. He was a guy who never paid his war taxes and was quite public about it, and he was very courageous in that regard. Started the Resource Center for Nonviolence. But on homeless issues, he became worse and worse, as I think all politicians do who enter the city council swamp. It becomes something that just catches you up. It's an internal process. The city council itself is actually an adjunct to the city staff, which is a it outlives all city councils, and it gets paid much more than city council members. So it's a difficult situation. In any case, I again range far afield here, but the issue that David Silva here, who called in, who is also a city council candidate at one time, and he also pushed for three different initiatives to end the sleeping ban during the 90s. And it was quite a struggle. We didn't quite get them on the ballot. It takes a lot of work to get initiatives on the ballot. You need thousands of registered voters to sign. And that sounds easier than it is, because a lot of people, you actually need probably about 6,000 or 7,000 people doing that. And to do that, even though you only need 4,000 legal voters' signatures, because a lot of them are just people don't know where they live. They think they live in Santa Cruz, but they don't. They live in Live Oak, but you write down Santa Cruz as your postal address. It's kind of a strange thing. In any case, we've been to Merchants, and after that 1994 series of protests, we announced a boycott of six businesses that were instrumental in supporting the sitting ban. One of them was the bookshop Santa Cruz, or the bookshop Coonerty. Another one was the ID building. Another one was a thing called Cat and Canary, which is a big store, which is now where it's a Mexican restaurant, not the Taqueria, across from the Taqueria at Cathcart and Pacific. Yeah. And there were a number of stores that one of them was the now defunct Game-A-Lot, who I was friends with the owner, and it became depressing to me that I haven't been able to buy anything from him in 20 years because of his support for these anti-homeless ordinances. Otherwise, fine, you know, good people, I like them, I've known them for years, but on these issues we took a militant stand, and I don't know what kind of impact the boycott had, frankly, it's hard to say. We did a similar boycott in 2010, I believe it was, might have been 2009, where we were concerned about the cities going after two homeless people, Ana Richardson and Miguel de Leon, two musicians who simply refused to leave the downtown area at night. They felt they had a right to be there. And they were never arrested for any violent crimes whatsoever. It was all sleeping, trespass, sitting in the wrong location. But the city, in order to get rid of them, took out a civil injunction against them. And eventually, they were able to drive them out. Although I occasionally have talked to Miguel de Leon, who I also call Lido. He plays the drums. He's a sort of a very outspoken fellow, and I've had him on the air before. So the question about what we did was, we then began we asked people to put a little notice in their window, business window, saying, we support not the right to sleep anywhere and everywhere, but the right to sleep somewhere. And a number of businesses agreed to do that. And we asked people to patronize shops that had those little cards in their window. And again, it's hard to say how effective that was, but it certainly was a nice little card, and I still have some of them around. Some years before that, when these new anti-homeless ordinances were intensified in 2002 and the move-along law was created that said you have to move every hour, we kind of co-created an organization called Downtown for All, and we did ask that all... we asked for a boycott of some of the businesses at that time, too. I don't know that there's ever been... Well, there was one successful threatened boycott of a business. It was very effective. Jack's Hamburgers, across from the Red Church, the Calvary Episcopal Church, began denying service uniformly to the people who were across the street who went to visit the church when they wanted to buy hamburgers, when they wanted to buy anything. They were just refused by the basis of their dress and how they looked. And I contacted the owner. We heard about this at a Huff meeting. Huff is homeless... So I contacted the owner after learning about this at the Huff meeting, and we put out flyers inviting people next week to come to a massive protest in front of Jack's. And damned if she didn't contact me and said, let's work it out. And I said, fine, all we want is we don't... So, well, you can't... People have been crapping in the back of my place. And I said, well, We certainly don't support that. I mean, you know, if somebody craps in the back of your place, you not only have the right not to serve them, you have the right to, you know, file a charge against them. I mean, you know, particularly if it's in the day when your restaurant is open and there are a few public restrooms available during the day. But there were none at that time open at night. Now there's one. Two, if you're allowed in the homeless lack of services center on the edge of town. And she said, well, we can't have them walking in with no shoes. And I said, no, and I appreciate that, although we hope you apply the same, you know, standard to surfers and that sort of thing, who are well-to-do. And she said, yeah, we agreed. And we came up with an understanding, and they started serving people, and it all evaporated before the protest. But that was not a typical situation, as far as I can see. And it didn't necessarily... It doesn't necessarily suggest that a boycott is the best way to go or not. I mean, it's really an open question for me. I'm going into it because of the caller, and I so value you callers. If you decide you want to call in again, the number is 427-3772. And I think I'm going to take a musical break here in order to, who knows, maybe let somebody else start do some talking, perhaps. That's a possibility. See if that works. I've been kind of picking out selections from this disc in the past, and we'll do so again now. And these are sort of songs which are, it's from an album called Sowing the Seeds. And Sowing the Seeds has got a variety of artists. It's 20th anniversary, it's called. I'm not sure what it's the anniversary of. But let's hear some of these songs, or at least one or two of them. How's about... we start with this one.
By starlight, the highest and best.
The roar of the engine, the first in its lifetime, will take what men value and spit out the rest.
There goes the mountain, the avalanche maker. Caretaker, breeder of streams. There goes the mountain, maker of thunder, torn down for the plunder, remembered in dreams.
Lord of the highland,
home for the eagle.
catcher of snowfall for millions of years.
Bleeding in mudslides,
robbed of its insides.
Prey to the skills of the cruel engineer.
There goes the mountain, the avalanche maker, heaven's caretaker, breeder of streams. There goes the mountain, maker of thunder, torn down for the plunder, remembered in dreams. Remembered in dreams. Remembered in dreams.
And that was a little something called There Goes the Mountain by Tom Paxton and Ann Hills. Actually, I think I played that one before, but we'll be playing some relatively new ones. Soon, so don't go away. Let's hear some more from an interview with Kate Wenzel back in November, earlier last year.
14 feet away from the building.
So then needed permission from
property owner, really, I think.
Where was this happening?
This is a sway store, and I just went in and asked the lady I see her every day if I could just sit outside for until the other lady, until the customer came back.
Right.
And she said that sure. So
sit outside where?
Right underneath. See this light overhang over there.
You were on there, supposedly their property, though it's the public sidewalk.
I'm not sure, but one of the hospitality ladies came by and she asked me, she said, I know it's raining, but the city ordinance still states that you have to be 14 feet from a building. And I said, well, I checked inside and they gave me permission and I'm just waiting for a customer to come back. And the hospitality lady says, oh, okay, well, in that case it might be okay because you've got the permission and I'm so happy for you that you have a customer coming. So they really, I don't get any feeling from them of animosity.
And interestingly enough, this shows the hospitality workers are as clueless as Kate Wenzel was in this situation, because if the place was open, I'm sure she would not have placed her stand in the alcove, which would block the entranceway going in. She must have been on the sidewalk in front of one of these businesses, and that the idea that somehow she goes and asks them permission and they give it shows a misunderstanding both on her part of the business, and also the part of the hospitality people. You can't do that. She either has a right to be on the sidewalk or she doesn't. And what the merchant pressed city council has done is they have made it so that you can't be on most of the sidewalk. You can only be there for a very limited period of time and have to leave for 24 hours after you've been there if you're there with any kind of a display device, like a guitar with an open guitar case and so forth. Or, in Kate's case, a table where she's displaying her scarves.
Sometimes I get it a little bit.
They're very sweet as they drive people away who don't have permission.
You know, I don't ever blame the police or the people enforcing laws, because they don't make them. Their job is just to enforce them. And I see guilt in them sometimes because they probably didn't sign up for that, but that's what they're doing. That's their job. So the people you really have to look at are the people making the laws. And the people making the laws oftentimes say that they're doing it on behalf of citizens. And this is where you really have to look at which citizens are they listening to. It's usually the ones, the squeaky wheels that they're listening to, and money. So, you know, most average people, things that, like this don't affect them, they don't get involved. If you're one being directly affected, then you're more likely to get involved.
Well, it's very nice of you. My problem, of course, is that these yellow jackets and blue armed gunmen who run around enforcing these laws, however guilty they may feel and however nicely they do it, are hurting a lot of people. And it's very nice to say, well, they're just enforcing the law, but in fact,
there enforcing the law?
Well, I was up in Ashland, Oregon, and I was selling scarves up there. First day I got in, I was outside a co-op, and they told me I couldn't sell. I need a permit. So I said, how do I get a permit? They told me, they gave me a phone number. I called, and they said, there is no permit. You can't.
Same thing is true in Santa Cruz.
So I knew from day one it would be illegal to sell on the street. I tried everything else I could have done legally to sell my scarves, and it turned out the only thing that really worked, and it worked really well, was selling on the street. So I ended up doing it for a month and a half.
But you left town.
Because in that town, basically, the police only come if somebody puts a complaint on you. And nobody complained on me until the very day that I got complained against was, this is such an ironic story, it drove me insane, but Hollywood was in town filming a movie called Wild, and they were setting up a stage downtown in the plaza of hippies, fake hippies selling stuff on the plaza.
With real people they didn't want around.
And the city administrator called a complaint on me the day before the shoot. So it wasn't about the citizens at all.
You should have demanded a salary to sit there and sell your stuff.
I went down, I snuck on set and got filmed anyway as my little protest. I'm going to get an actual street person on this film.
Well,
but
you didn't get paid for your time, Juan.
Yeah, another quick note. At the time that I talked to her, this was in November of last year, I said, you hear me mentioning, they don't get permits for selling stuff on Pacific Avenue. That was what I had been told for 25 years. Suddenly, the next month, they started demanding permits. And in fact, Kate was probably the first or second victim of a campaign by Officer Barnett to make her be legal according to this new interpretation, this new harassment device being used against people on Pacific Avenue. Again, it's really hard to tell whether there's any consistent motivation as to what prompts this, whether it's simply a bureaucrat deciding to enforce an ordinance, not even with an intention of driving it in a way, but because it's on the books and it has to be enforced, which is almost never a wise thing to do, although it appears to have a certain patina of fairness, because you might say, well, how can you sometimes enforce it and sometimes not? I mean, you know, like what Pat Colby was showing at the her own demonstration at the city council on Tuesday, which was there seems to be a selective kind of enforcement going on here. And indeed, downtown now, today, last week, last month, probably since January, there has been very little enforcement of the display device ordinance in terms of people being actually ticketed for being within 14 feet of something. They're certainly harassed and driven away. But I haven't heard of anybody getting a ticket in the last few months at all around this. Perhaps Pat Colby, who's in the studio, has more information. Pat, have you heard anybody getting the citations?
I think they got a citation
around March. And Pat says that you probably can't hear her. Just Kate got a citation around March.
March 17th.
March 17th, yep, because I know, Pat, you took out to kind of defend Pat from a particularly officious officer, Officer Barnett. Yeah, and she went down there, and actually you were calling his superiors and demanding he leave her alone. You can't talk from a distance if you're talking to the community. You got to get over here to the mic if you want. But as far as I know, there haven't been a lot of citations issued. And indeed, it's interesting. It's kind of ironic hearing Kate talk about how nice the hosts were and how nice the police were in November, because subsequently she got into all kinds of problems. You want to summarize what happened with Kate in the months that followed, Pat?
Yeah, well, she got one ticket for not having a business license. She got another ticket for setting up in the same place within a 24-hour period. So that meant, like, for example, if she sold Monday in that spot, she couldn't go in that same spot on the street within 24 hours on Tuesday, which she didn't realize. I mean, that's kind of a weird interpretation. She thought it just meant like a day instead of actually 24 hours. What's happening is CSO Barnett was doing the judge's job, and he was interpreting the law.
CSO is a community service officer.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so then she was just being harassed when she was in legal spots. She was being told it wasn't right. She was being told she wasn't moving along. She was so scared. There was times that she didn't even sell. So eventually what I did is I would sit with her with my camera, my video, and my audio recorder, digital, and I would protect her from Barnett or any other officer. In fact, I caught many officers not following their procedure handbook, and so I would get them on digital and with photos and stuff. And so basically, they pretty much, when I was there, they stayed away from us completely.
What was your response when an officer came up? Or did they, I understand you had, later they tended to avoid you, but when in those occasions when you had contact with the officers, what, give an example of something typical that happened.
Well, we had measured a spot in front of, by the corner of Forever 21. We had measured it 14 feet, 14 feet. We measured out 14 feet with pieces of yarn, and we checked everything. We were in total compliance, and then CSO Barnett drove by in his car, stopped there, stared at her, and then he yelled out of his window, "You can't be there." And so I said off with my audio recorder with me, I said, "Officer Barnett, could you please come out and show us then where she should be?" And he just grunted, and then he finally drove away. But he never did show us what was illegal about what we were doing. And this happened a couple times.
Often police, particularly police, and more than hosts, so I think, you know, in their way, try to be accurate and officious, but are actually often clueless. But they don't try to throw their weight around with an eye to driving people on, but not carrying through. They will carry through, I think, if they're really challenged. Whereas police will often bluff, and they will tell you, "You can't do this; it's illegal. Get going." And you know, they don't really mean they're going to spend any time trying to enforce what they're suggesting, particularly if what they're suggesting is just not the case. And that seemed to be, that was certainly your perception of that, what happened that day in front of Forever 21.
I asked for his help, and he wouldn't come out and do it and show us what was wrong.
Well, he wasn't a squad car.
Yeah, but he could have parked.
Was there a parking spot?
Yes. There was clear. He was in the morning. There was nobody down there yet.
I see. Interesting.
And then he would hide behind bushes and just stare at her for long periods of time, which I photographed.
Wait a minute. There are actually bushes on Pacific Avenue to hide behind?
Yeah, bushes like in front of people's stores, little toperies. Mm. And he would hide behind those and stare at her. He had a real obsession. We got to the point where we thought maybe, you know, we were all three in a relationship with him. Well, both of us were in a relationship
did
with
you,
him.
Did you ever date this officer?
No, but we were thinking about inviting him out for free coffee and donuts and, you know, maybe, you know, getting him to be just a little bit friendlier.
Unwind and kind of see
what
the problem is.
We thought maybe he just
corrupt
wanted some,
the local police force.
He just wanted donuts and coffee or something. Or maybe he was just too scared to come and ask for a scarf or something.
Officer Barnett is a tall officer. I think he's still on Pacific Avenue, no?
Yes, he is.
And I've even seen a new CSO. I think I used to call him Big John. He used to be a security guard over at the library, and I felt he was quite intimidating on a number of occasions to a number of people. They apparently have upgraded him and now made him a uniformed CSO police officer, if it's the same guy. Mike, you're nodding. Do you recognize him? Come closer to the mic if you want to talk, Mike.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. He was at the library. He works at the library, and he works downtown on Pacific. I've seen him in both areas.
Does he now work as a CSO, or is he still First Alarm?
No, he's CSO.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And also, he's very official. I mean, I was missing a bag at the library the other day, temporarily, but he didn't seem to care too much about the library. He's more interested in getting me out there. It was the end of the day at the library. So I thought that he was lacking in compassion, basically, and just an official person. That was my impression.
Also, I want to point out, with Barnett, I'm kind of curious. I'm probably going to have my brother do a public records request as to what kind of health status officers should be in. Because I know that growing up, there, like when I was in my 30s, there was some friends of my parents, and he was a sheriff in L.A., and he actually got suspended for a while because he was so overweight when he drove a sheriff's bus, and when one of their inmates got out, and he went to chase him. He was so overweight he couldn't chase him, and so he got suspended from duty for that. And Barnett...
Couldn't that be discrimination based on disability?
Well, there's certain...
Disability advocate, Pat Colby?
No, there's certain requirements for jobs, and I know that there's definitely physical requirements for a police job, and I don't think Barnett meets any of those. So maybe he's just...
I think we've had our share of weighty police officers in Santa Cruz. I've never heard of them, anybody being fired for being overweight. But, you know, I don't know what the standards of the police department are, if they have any in that regard. There may be some, I don't know. In any case, a little more from Kate Wenzel back in November, and maybe we'll
can
even
get... Can I just add one more question?
I don't know. Can you? Go ahead.
Well, may I? It's like, I just have to ask myself, there's certain officers I see and I say, now, would I want this officer protecting me? Would I feel protected if this officer came to a call? And I would say, I definitely would not want Barnett to come in a call that was serious where I needed protection.
Well, you have had bad experiences with Barnett, would say the devil.
Plus, I don't think he physically could handle the situation.
Well, he has a truncheon, doesn't he? And maybe some pepper spray. I could... whip it out and deal with a criminal sitter.
Maybe he could fall on him.
No fat jokes, please. I don't want my bulk referred to here on the air. Anyway, let's hear some more from Kate Wenzel and me back in November.
You know, the irony, though, but what I really see happening kind of all over is commercialism. I really see money, money, money starting to make a lot of rules. And the city council says, oh, the citizens of Ashland decided they didn't want people selling stuff on the sidewalk. I had to beg to differ. All the citizens that I saw love my stuff. And so I went down and I talked to them about it.
It's not about the citizens. It's about a privileged group of so-called representatives who are pressured by small interest groups of snotty business people and conservative residents. So if they were put to a vote in the citizenry, it could be an entirely different matter.
Now, I agree, and they do have public hearings, but how much the average person gets involved, they don't always understand how much it affects them, and here's what I say about selling on the streets. As a local artisan, I'm able to sell to you a scarf directly $20. Now, when these laws are enforced that push me so that I can't sell directly to you, it pushes me to find a middleman. At this point,
or
now,
middle woman.
Or middle woman, middle person. At this point now, my commission, I mean, they had taken their cut. I'm upping my price. Now my scarf is $25. I find most people don't want to spend $25 on a scarf when you can go to Walgreens and get a $13 scarf. So what is...
You know, yours are more colorful.
Yeah, and handmade, and they have... I put mantra into them. I put love into them. But, you know, what the average person is being sold the story, okay, we're going to get these dirty hippies off the street for you. But what they're not being told is what we're doing is we're putting in a middleman so that local artisans can't really sell except for to people who have enough money to buy. And so everything else is going to be made in China. There's a snowball effect that happens that affects people, and they don't always understand the ramifications of these laws.
So because you, as economics minister, and sort of these hacks that the pure Obama has got going.
I mean, we're talking right now about local politics. We're not talking about federal politics.
Well, the reason it's good, the China stuff is happening is because of national politics.
Yeah, that's true. But it's reflected in the attitudes all over. And the most chance that we as people have a chance to make a voice is in our own cities, in our own city councils. And I've never been involved in city council. And for the first time ever, I've started getting involved. I had to leave Ashland because the rain started coming. It was too cold.
Sleeping outside illegally in Santa Cruz?
I am, and I was there too.
Shocking.
And unfortunately, I wasn't able to then make money to rent a room and make it through the winter. So these are the things on me. But I take responsibility for my life choice as well. And, you know, I have to find a way. Probably I'll be selling scarves on the internet or something in order to, because I can't rely on cities to be able to sell anymore directly to people. So this is personal, but it's also affects everyone in the large, in the long run, and people aren't always aware. But I think, you know, when you talk about street people, it brings up a lot of issues that are a lot bigger than just economic. You've got a lot of stuff coming up.
And we'll be getting our economic analysis from...
What do you mean?
Your name is?
Oh, Kate.
Kate,
how can people reach you, Kate?
If you wanted to talk to me, you can reach me on my email, or that's Kate Wenzel, KateWenzell at yahoo.com, or my phone number is 831-212-3162.
And there you have it, folks. Get warm, get a pretty scarf, help a person to eventually find a nook in a overpriced motel for one out of the next 43 nights of the winter. Thanks for talking to me.
Thank you.
And now we're going to turn to the city council meeting of the 24th, 2 days ago, where you, Pat, were giving your PowerPoint presentation, for which Mayor Robinson gave you 5 minutes, surprisingly enough. And you also, Kate Wenzel was waiting there just in case she hadn't been willing to give you 5 minutes, as I didn't think she would, because it's an unusual, I think it's unusual was for oral communications. And as I mentioned to you earlier today, I wrote her an email and said, I'm pleased to hear that she got 5 minutes, and I'm sure that there will be no further problems with any of this audio nonsense at the next council meeting. I was referring, of course, to the April 1st arrest, when I myself was forced to leave the council and actually arrested by an officer for tape recording, as I usually do. And next council meeting is July 8th. We'll see what she does, and we'll see what I do. So let's hear your presentation now, and that of some of the other people at the oral, during oral communications. And again, perhaps you might be aware, if you just tuned in, or you might not be aware, that this is 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. I'm here in the studio with Michael O'Grady and Pat Colby, and I'm Robert Norris, and who knows who you are? You can call in 427-3772 if you'd like.
June 24th, Santa Cruz City Council meeting, oral communications, 5 o'clock.
Hi, Chairman. Do you mind being here while I get just something? I'm just... So Mercedes Sheldon will come up for her announcement for Spanish translation, and we'll get started with oral communication.
So with that, our first speaker in oral communication is Mr. David.
And our next speaker for oral communication. And in advance, Ms. Patricia Colby did ask for time representing an organization, and in this case it would be HUF. So I think you did check with the clerk in advance, so you have a PowerPoint that's ready to go. Okay, so she'll put the timer on and you'll have 5 minutes. All right.
Now, as Pat sets up her presentation, the next voice you'll hear will be that of Pamela Comstock, who was a person prominently criticized in Pat's presentation.
Good afternoon.
And we see this live presentation in front of us.
Are you looking for my quote? I can tell you what it was.
The person that said that was, who are you looking for my quote, was Pamela Comstock. And, of course, she was referring to, I think, one of the centerpieces of your presentation, which is about to come up. Anything you want to say before that starts, or shall we just roll it?
Yeah, I had been told, I didn't hear these comments, but I had been told by someone, well, a few people on Facebook, that there was these remarks and some others.
Pat, she was just trying to be helpful, Pat.
Oh, maybe she was.
Who knows?
So... City Council members, my name is Pat Colby, and I want to discuss an apparent double standard of what some might call selective enforcement of laws downtown. In particular, I'd like to focus on laws that relate to defining the public spaces. Many taxpayers are insulted that characteristics unique to Santa Cruz appear to be under attack by city officials and city law enforcement. I am speaking specifically now of our downtown street performers and artisans. Over the years, tourists have come to appreciate the uniqueness of our street performers and entertainment. It's part of what makes our city special and what distinguishes us from the thousands of cookie-cutter malls in our state and our nation. Yet despite this uniqueness, at a previous city council meeting, May 13th, many onlookers and viewers were shocked that council member Pamela Comstock referred to our performers and artisans as sidewalk clutter. Her remark was echoed and affirmed by city council member Cynthia Matthews and Mayor Lynn Robinson. Many people were shocked at the negative tone of these remarks and started asking themselves online and in person the question, what is sidewalk clutter really? I, along with other members of the public, decided to research how much our downtown public sidewalk has been left to the public and how much has been taken over by other uses. Our research documented numerous sandwich board signs not only cluttering but also impeding traffic and in some cases actually blocking public downtown sidewalks. In documenting these various and numerous obstructions, the majority of visitors who seemed severely impacted were the elderly and the disabled protected by the Americans with Disabilities Act, also known as the ADA. In addition to the signs, we documented a number of downtown public sidewalks which had been taken over by unattractive, cluttered tables and chairs that didn't match. The signs and the seats seemed to take up a great deal of the public space, and as you can see, this occurs in an extremely haphazard, unattractive manner. As you can see, while most of the stores have only one sandwich board, some do have two or more on the public sidewalk. Often they are outside the merchant's property, protruding into the sidewalk, and some even into the middle of the lane of the sidewalk lane, blocking smooth traffic flow. The most horrific examples were the signs taking over so much sidewalk space that they clearly violated the ADA by making it difficult for elderly and disabled people to have equal use of the public sidewalks. And all this makes me question the legality of the city and city council allowing all of the above. In the last year, the city council, city staff, and city law enforcement have acted to severely restrict performers' access to the sidewalks. And with all of this intense daily scrutiny and focus, how is it that you, the city staff, and the law enforcement failed to notice all the illegal sandwich board signs cluttering up Pacific Avenue? And when I say illegal, I mean that according to Code Law, Zoning Ordinance Section 24.12.320.3, what would be illustrative is the answer to the question. How many merchants have been ticketed in the same period of time that street performers and artists have been issued citations? How many merchants have been told to take down or move their signs the same way CSO officers have been telling performers to move on? If the answer is disproportionately that the city laws are being applied to one group or people while another group of people are not being held accountable, it seems to be the case that is clearly seen in the photographs I am showing you today, then the question is, why? Are we in a town that applies laws equally to all without consideration of race or economic standing or housing status? Or is it the power and the force of the city government being utilized to focus on criminalizing the behavior that people, that city council and various lobbying and special interest groups have decreed undesirables? The latest group being street performers and artists. I certainly hope that this isn't the case and that friends, relatives, business associates, or campaign contributors of city council members or city leaders aren't getting special treatment. I think I can safely observe that many citizens would take exception to the idea that a certain class of people get to break city laws while others have to obey them. So I ask the city council as well as the public to continue to ask the question, why is it some of the special magic of downtown Santa Cruz is being squeezed out and criminalized by our city leaders while others? Thank you.
Sounds like you were cut off right in the middle of a sentence there, Pat.
Yes, and I ran out of time, and I knew I had 5 minutes. And so that's why I brought Kate Wenzel, so that she could continue the rest.
And was there more to continue, or were you largely
there? I got most of it in there. I thought I had rushed. Listening to it now, it doesn't sound as rushed as I felt.
No, it was fine. I apologize for the quality of the recording again. This is another example of how difficult it is, at least for me, to make recordings from a distance. I didn't come to the city council meeting because I don't feel it's pertinent to go to council meetings where you're not allowed to have access, that they don't have access to the media in the way that has traditionally been the case. and in a way that allows me to actually make the recordings that I make to go on the air. I was able to do this, and people say, well, what's your complaint? The answer is I had to sit by the tape recorder. I had to sit by the, actually, the by both the tape recorder and a computer. And also, I couldn't come to the council meeting. I couldn't be there to give public testimony at the same time. Or if I did, it would require a setup that I don't have, I'm not familiar with. And I would say that sometimes the average homeless person or the average poor person may not have, and they certainly should have a right to do the kind of recording that they need to do. These should be open meetings. Anyway, that's a constant clarion call that I'll be repeating. But we're talking about your issue. Actually, it's an issue that much more broadly concerns all of us, Pat. Any comments about what you heard and saw at that council meeting and something you might have wanted to put into your presentation but you weren't able to, or the reaction of the city council, whatever?
I wish that, you know, if I was given more time to slow down, I could have seen the reaction of the city council members, because I did get a feeling when I quoted the law, there was like a sense of, oh, my God. It was the big surprise they didn't know about.
It was not shown visually on the stream for the downtown, or I should say for the at-home viewers. All you could see was your PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah, so they'll never know that I had a breakout that day, and also the faces of the city council members. But from what Kate described, they all went stone-faced during my speech. Mm. So I guess I had a pretty good reaction.
I thought it was a good speech. I made a fine summary of the speech for you, which you cast aside heedlessly. But nonetheless, I thought it was good. Let's hear some more of the oral communication. I think Kate followed your presentation.
Thank you very much, and thank you again for asking in advance. Next speaker, anyone for oral communication, this is your opportunity, and you'll have 3 minutes. And now's your opportunity, otherwise someone else will come to the podium. Okay, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I don't know if this is gonna.
Yeah, that's perfect.
My name is Kate Wenzel. I'm finishing on behalf of Pat Colby and Huff. While others are clearly violating the law and are seemingly avoiding any scrutiny or responsibility, Pacific Avenue is for all of us in the community to enjoy, and it's not just for shopping. Why are there seemingly one rule for merchants and another for the rest of us?
There is an attempt to cut her off very quickly with a thank you very much, but Kate is not a woman to be cut off quickly. I can tell you that from experience.
Yep. With my own experience, being a street artist downtown for 8 months now in Santa Cruz, that I have a whole case documented of discrimination. I brought it to court, but the judge dismissed the ticket. But nonetheless, I've been documenting for months and months. But certain people are having the law applied more stringently than others. And even though I've been through the mill, this discrimination continues to this day. And in particular, there are certain people who are never told that they have to move every hour, whereas I've been told many, many times and I'm constantly reminded I need to move every hour. For instance, the Farm Fresh U table, as far as I know, none of these people. The Homeless Garden Project volunteers who block traffic, and the Greenpeace people, who are all very aggressive with their sales or with their attempt to sign people up. I'm not aggressive, I just sit there, I do my thing. And yet I'll have an officer walk right by them and come and beeline to me and tell me I gotta move. And a lot of times there's a lot of rules and it's hard to apply all of them at once on one person. On Saturday we had a preacher out who was, he had amplified voice. I saw an officer go straight to him and double check he had a permit and let him go with that. And yet he was within 14 feet of a kiosk, a garbage can, and a crosswalk. I had to ask a hospitality person, and it's for the first time I've ever done this to another person out there, but I felt the man was very offensive. And I had to ask the hospitality to enforce that code because the officer did not. And then the officer came around later and told me I have to move every hour. And so it's...
And it has to be said here, but for the purposes of accuracy, Kate, again, is, even after 11 months here, she's not got the rules clear either. You can stay as long as you want, even playing an instrument, if you don't have what's called a display device. And that's not a sign saying I'm wonderful or come give me money. It is a a thing capable of holding tangible things, like a table, a cup, and it has to be on public property. So, for example, you could have a display device attached to your clothes, and you could stay there for wherever, as long as you want. You could stay within 14 feet of a building, provided you were standing or sitting on your own chair, and provided you weren't panhandling. You can. There's always a difference between panhandling and busking, performing for donation on public property. Those are distinguished and under the Santa Cruz Code. But preaching, or preaching, you could preach for hours if you want, and you can. Do you want to say something, Pat, on this?
From what I understood from Kate is he had some kind of setup, some kind of table.
Oh, if he had a table, then he did have a display device, and she's quite accurate. I thought she was talking about the Greenpeace people, and they usually don't have a table. They usually simply are running around with clipboards and, you know, kind of buttonholing you on the street and wanting you to donate money to this and that.
She has a really, one of the better understandings. Sometimes she's had to show the officer that they were incorrect or the host that they were incorrect, mm-hmm. that she's followed the rules and they didn't know them. That's the whole problem, is nobody knows the rules. Why are people getting ticketed when nobody's even sure of anything?
Well, to me, the rules are very specific, as I've said to you many a time. They aren't unclear at all, unless you want to talk about, there may be some confusion about the 24-hour rule, but as for location rules, it's quite clear. You can't be 14 feet from this, 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 or this. And 14 feet isn't 5 feet, it isn't 40 feet, it's 14 feet. And if they're talking about a building is a building. A fence is a fence. An intersection is an intersection. It's really pretty clear.
What I'm saying is they're getting tickets even though they're within those parameters.
You mean now, outside the parameters, but within the law.
Right. And, of course, when you go to court...
Well, then the cops are acting illegally.
Right. When you go to court, it's always the assumption that you're the liar and the cop is telling the truth.
Well, that's true, but that doesn't mean the law itself is confusing. What it means is that police, as ever, have special prerogatives in court. What you need, of course, is you need to bring along some kind of additional evidence. You know, I don't know, a judge who happens to be watching nearby.
They don't give you the time. They don't want to hear it.
And
I watched this.
You have a right to hear it. And the way you do it is you have to demand things like preliminary hearings, and you have to use the law. But it takes time and energy. It's something the average person, even the person who's been through this mill a couple times, may not be aware of. So it doesn't. It's not an easy process, and it's not a fair process. At the end of all this, a judge can still say guilty.
You know? Well, we were ready to do this on one of her tickets because we had all the evidence. I collected, she collected, and then she was kind of upset because the judge dismissed that because he didn't want it to show up at a hearing or in front of a jury or in front of anybody else. He just like said, oh, I'm going to dismiss it. And she was really bummed out because she wanted to show that she was right.
Well, she can always demand a hearing for factual innocence if she wants. That's another another. That's more difficult to prove. Recently, one of the Santa Cruz 11 tried to do that with a fancy attorney and was turned down. That was Bradley Stewart, or Bradley Allen, who was falsely accused of felony vandalism, felony conspiracy to trespass, felony conspiracy to vandalize. All charges were dropped. He was one of the seven, and I was one of the seven as well, where all these charges were dropped for a peaceful... where both of us were reporting on an occupation of a building at 75 River Street, a Wells Fargo leased bank building that had been vacant and is still vacant. Even though all the charges were dropped, he still has a felony arrest on his record, so he can't get a teaching credential. And in order to deal with that issue, to get the felony arrest expunged, he wanted to go and get a... He requested a hearing for factual innocence. Judge Burdick, the same judge who dismissed the charge against him, said he would not grant a factual innocence hearing because there was some evidence against him. That is, there was some unnamed photo or something. Not enough to take him to trial, but presumably enough to justify his arrest. Although, I can't see that a... You can arrest someone on what you believe is probable cause, but if you then find you were wrong about that issue, or there is insufficient evidence to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, or even to take the case to trial, it seems to me that you're getting pretty close to factual innocence. But in fact, what the judge requires is a finding that there is no evidence of any crime. And if he had found that, that would lay open the Santa Cruz Police Department to civil charges of a lawsuit for false arrest.
So probably not in their best interest.
And it also would have laid the judges open to charges of misconduct for issuing arrest warrants, which were served on at least three of the defendants, where they were taken from their homes or jobs in handcuffs. Becky Johnson was one of those that this happened to. So it's still something that could be done. I mean, I've almost never heard of a factual innocence hearing being undertaken for an infraction case, because it's such a minor case. But it could be something if somebody wanted to spend the time and do the research or find an attorney who wanted to deal with this issue. And we used to have such attorneys in town.
Can I give you a quote from Kate as to her last things before she left town?
So Kate has left.
Yeah. Can we use the F word on air?
Fuck no.
Well, she said, "I'm getting the fuck out of Santa Cruz."
I see.
And she was smiling and happy and couldn't wait to leave.
Well, you can take fuckers out of Santa Cruz, but you can't take Santa Cruz out of the... that's not right.
Santa Cruz is fucked.
Santa Cruz has its problems. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. Free fucking radio, I would say. We don't cater to censorship here, unless, of course, we're talking hate speech, in which case you get to call in and complain, and we have to listen to complaints about our hate speech usage. Hate speech is where we are talking about groups of people who are what they are because of how they were born and not because of the political chicaneries they've decided to engage in. In other words, it's perfectly okay to talk about those bastard politicians and their abuses, those war criminals who are destroying our country and bankrupting it. But if you start talking about niggers who are, you know, inferior on this station, which I don't, because I don't believe in that, but I do refer to some people who are being treated as poor people who are being treated like, quote, niggers, because I believe that poor people are the new niggers in that sense. They are the new WOPs or SPICs or
and
kikes.
That's all fucked up.
And that is all fucked up. We have a caller, though. Let's see what kind of call we have. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Hello? Boy.
Hello?
Can you hear me? Having trouble with you
on
the...
This is Eric Thornton, calling for the Fraternal Order of Police, California State Lodge. The call is recorded for quality assurance, okay?
Go ahead, Eric.
Sir, the reason for my call, the state FOP just kicked off their fund drive, and as a paid fundraiser for residential programs, we're sending out the new pledge kit to all supporting residents.
Uh-huh.
And the goal of the drive is to provide financial assistance to officers or their families who have suffered a tragedy or catastrophe.
Eric,
training
let me,
and educational
Eric, can you,
assistance,
Eric,
as
Eric,
well
Eric,
as scholarship.
Hello. Eric, can you hear me? Eric? Can you hear me?
Uh-huh.
Where are you calling from?
The Fraternal Order of Police California State Lodge is based in Willits, California.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, it's interesting. You're actually on the air. Do you want to make an appeal on the air for police funding? Because you certainly, we have you're a free speech radio here if you'd like to make an appeal.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. In other words, what I'm saying to you is you actually called a live radio station, and you are currently on the air. So if you want to no, that's okay. You want to put out an appeal to the community, go ahead.
No problem.
Okay. Are you going to do that, or shall we move on?
No problem. Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, thank you. That has never happened to me before. I've never gotten an appeal from the...
I thought we were in trouble for saying fuck.
From the Brotherhood of... No, no. In any case, well, let's hear some more from the oral communications period. This is Kate Wenzel talking 2 days ago, before she left town, to the Santa Cruz City Council.
It's constant. It's consistent. And I just wanted to give my experience to help back up what Huff is fighting for. I believe most of our citizens like having our artists and performers downtown. I have a whole album of beautiful art and performance that goes on down there. Oh, tourists as well. So I don't feel that it's representative of the average Santa Cruzian or even tourist. To try and crack down so much on people doing art and performance, which is really unique. You go to other places, you don't see this culture, and it's beautiful. And then why it's okay, though, to have more aggressive people doing stuff that seem more legitimate? We don't know the reasons why this is happening. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And the only two speakers that I expected to hear that I was interested in listening to were you, Pat, and Kate. But I was pleasantly surprised to hear other speakers talking about issues that were not too far afield, or at least challenging authority in ways I felt was a very healthy kind of thing to do. Things that no city council member does, things that most speakers at city council and certainly no staff do, and that few media do either.
Good afternoon.
Hello, I'm Pat Kittle, Santa Cruz. Today I'd like to discuss something that probably needs to be discussed, specifically the Israel lobby. Just to give a little background here, the Israel lobby has an awful lot of impact on our daily lives as well as big national and international events, and yet it usually flies under the radar. So I think it's important that we kind of bring it out into the daylight and discuss the various aspects of it from all points of view, not just its point of view, which is pretty much all we get. Just to give you an example historically, we all know that the... I'll wait till you're done there, Lynn.
This is what I mean. I wasn't at the meeting, and I don't know if the camera was poised on Lynn Robinson when this was happening, but apparently Pat Kittle felt that Lynn was disregarding what he was saying and doing something else, either perhaps chatting with somebody else or turning away or reading something. And so instead of proceeding as though it wasn't happening, he called her on it. And he waited and paused until she paid some attention.
Had other business to tend to.
Well,
that's why
someone comes up to me, I do listen, but if you need another 10 seconds added on, that it was not a long disruption, but carry on.
Seems like whenever I'm talking, somebody gets distracted on the council more often than not. Not always, more often than not.
Mr. Keeling,
it is annoying.
On my behalf, that was not any conspiracy theory against your talk.
I didn't.
This is Pamela Comstock speaking. So apparently both Pamela and Lynn, or maybe... Unless Pat is mistaking Pamela for the mayor, I doubt it. She's off to the side, and Lynn, the mayor, sits in the middle of the podium. Anyway, let's hear some more.
It was, did I?
No, but please carry on.
I will.
Thank you.
The Israel lobby is what I'm talking about here. In 1967, the Vietnam War was greatly expanded as a result of a fictitious attack on the U.S. Navy warship. We probably all know about the Gulf of Tonkin incident, don't we? That was the excuse that the United States used for greatly expanding the Vietnam War. It was a total lie. The American Navy ship was never attacked. Meanwhile, within a couple of months of that event, a U.S. Navy ship actually was attacked on the other side of Asia. It was called the USS Liberty, and Israel attacked it. Israel has denied to this day that it did it, knowing it was an American ship. That is a blatant lie. If you go to the USS Liberty's own website, don't go to USS Liberty. The first return you'll get is Wikipedia, which is not going to tell you the whole story. The USS Liberty's website is GTR5.org. That's the alphanumerical designation that was on the ship's bow at the time. Israel attacked the ship with napalm, rockets, bombs, and when the survivors tried to put life rafts in the water, Israel's patrol boats fired, shot up the life rafts with 50 caliber machine gun fire. Later, the highest officials in the U.S. government were seething mad because they knew very well this was a lie. If you go to that website, you'll see lots of documentation for it. So we need to start talking about the Israel lobby. That happened 47 years ago. If I went out on the street, probably one person in 100 would know about the USS Liberty. But everybody should know about the USS Liberty. I hope people at home hearing this will look that up if you haven't done it yet, because it'll be an eye-opener. There are a lot of links on that site. Take your time and make sure that you look into it, because...
Thank you very much. That's, we gave you X time back, and you're at the end of your 3 minutes. So
well, it said 47 seconds. I was basing it on still having 47 seconds.
I can't do it by seconds. I can only do it by minutes. So you got extra time. I can tell you had a lot of extra time.
Yeah.
So thank you very much. And hopefully people will look up the site you're talking about.
So I was misled here by the...
The important thing about Pat's speech, I mean, it's interesting to hear about this historical stuff about the 67... torpedoing of the USS Liberty during the, I think it was the Six-Day War. But, and it's also important, interesting to know about the Presbyterian Church disinvesting this last week from companies that that arm Israeli occupation of the West Bank and so forth. And I myself have thought about asking the city council, I in the past have asked them to research where U.S. funds are invested, U.S. funds, where Santa Cruz funds are invested in war industries. And I got some sort of namby-pamby reply from the only Green Party member ever elected to city council way back 13 years ago when Fitzmaurice was the mayor and he was on the city council. But it indeed was this last council meeting where the financial portfolio of the city council came up for a vote. And that would have been a time to mention this, and what it might have been, perhaps if Pat had been more aware of that, he might have mentioned that too. But what's important here is he is being rushed off after he said, look, you know, I'm judging my speech based upon the amount of time I see on this little clock. And he saw he had 47 seconds left. And what happened was they reset the clock, but they only gave him 10 seconds. And so when it reached the point where he thought he had 47 seconds, they said, stop. And his point was not to scamper away like a mouse or to kind of meekly go off into the distance. His response was to say, wait a minute. I am being denied the right to speak the amount of time I have the right to be at the council mic. And this, I think, to me, this dogged determination to assert his rights is something I find admirable. Much as I have all kinds of objections to a number of Pat's opinions, he's very much anti-immigrant, for example, and I'm not. He recently was denied membership at Free Radio on the Collective. He wanted to get a show, and he was vetoed. Not by me, because of partially his views, and I think also his determination to make his views known in what one member viewed as a disruptive manner. Mayor Robinson might consider his presence at the mic here disruptive. I don't consider it disruptive at all, even though I'm often a little anxious. I've had Pat on my show. And I'll probably have him again because he's going to try to reapply for Free Radio, perhaps. And he needs to have a section for people to hear how he would run a show. Anyway, let's hear some more of how he responds to Lynn Robinson's get moving, get moving, we want the next speaker. Yes, yes, we fucked up, but tough shit for you. Let's see how he responds to that.
You actually had quite a bit more than 3 minutes there, and I can I don't have my clock in front of me, but
all right. Well, I'm just telling you that when you do something like this in the future, make sure that the speaker knows how much time they have left, because I
really noted. Thanks.
You are welcome.
All right. Anyone else speak?
And he was still he was feeling, as we all do, the pressure of authority when they drive you away from something, a place you really have a right to be. I mean, if they screwed up with their timing, then, yeah, they're going to have to give a little more time. They're going to have to stay a little later in the meeting. You know? And so that kind of goes with the job. But unfortunately, see, the tables are turned on us. Our rights are constricted because of our willingness to obey, to submit, to meekly agree with the powers that be. And perhaps some of the sympathies I have for people like Dr. Michael O'Grady here, who when he is told he can't be in a cafe because he has his backpacks are too big or he's been sitting there for too long, and he raises the issue, wait a minute, let me... And they say, no, you have to leave, and they sort of hustle him out. I tend to have respect for the fact that he asserts his position and attempts to retain the power that an average, in this case, it's a person who is houseless, because that's Michael's condition right now, that he asserts and keeps asserting and hopefully will successfully assert. There is a tendency for people to succumb to authority, because all our lives we're conditioned to the authority of the family, the authority of the school, the authority of the church, the authority of the army, the authority of the boss, the authority of our the peers around us. So that is, has more legitimacy than any of the other authorities. However, let's hear more from Oral Communications at the City Council meeting on the 24th of June.
Speak to us on communications. This is your opportunity. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Rosemary Sarka, and I am here representing Roaring Camp Railroads and Big Trees. I want to tell you that a train is coming to the west side.
Hello, my name is Nathaniel Kennedy, and I am a 25-year resident of Santa Cruz. I just have some stuff I want to read off here. First, I support all our emergency services, police, firemen, paramedics, and 911 dispatchers. They all have difficult jobs protecting us, the public. They put their lives on the line every day for us, and I support increasing the pay and or benefits they all receive. The brave firefighters are willing to run into a burning building to rescue us, and they don't get the credit they deserve, risking their lives every day. Second.
Before we hear more from Nathaniel, who I've known for years, he was one of the first people arrested for chalking on the sidewalk years ago. He's a sort of light-hearted, whimsical fellow. You may have seen him downtown. In years past, he's made little paper cranes that he gives away. I think that's something you were doing, Pat, at some one point, too.
Oh, he's incredible.
And, you know, I've always found it kind of, you know, thought he was a little bit light than the upstairs, you know, approach himself, myself. But here he gives a very coherent speech. It sounds like he's planning to run for city council, because this is indeed the season where people begin to put in their applications for running for city council if they want to. Pat Colby, are you throwing your hat into the ring for city council?
Can I use that F word again?
Yes, of course.
Fuck no.
I see. Well, there you are. What about you, Michael O'Grady? Are you a city council candidate coming up?
No, I need a lot more training. A lot more training. Maybe in 20 years.
Yeah, you can be toilet trained, not to shit all over the people. Yeah.
Right.
200-pound turds.
I got to be able to swing that hammer, you know?
Something, yeah. In any case, Nathaniel is, he begins his speech by talking about, oh, how wonderful the firemen and the police are, and they need more money and so forth, and I don't agree with him. But again, I think there's a mythology that fire and police are some of the most dangerous professions. They aren't. There are actually other more professions that are much more dangerous, at least according to what I've read. I think being a farmer can be being a trucker can be a more dangerous profession. I mean, the professions you wouldn't think of as being dangerous that are, where you're more likely to run into accidents or danger. But they have a huge lobby behind them, fire and police, and there is the illusion that they are creating protection for the community. I'm not saying that they don't in some cases do that. I think they do in some cases. I do commend police departments, our police department and our sheriff's department, when it, I think, deserves commendation. More often, I'm a critic, because I think there's far too much phony, unnecessary praise. Some of it heartfelt, perhaps, but I think a lot of it just based on a kind of a mythology rather than substantial and real things that have happened. And some of it can be downright detrimental and dangerous to the community, such as the massive hoopla raised around the shootings of Elizabeth Butler and Lauren Butchie Baker, I think it was last year, the idea that we'll be reviewing, when we review the DAP program, that's Downtowners Against the Poor, you know, program. It's also called the Downtown Accountability Project, which Steve Plaich did a panel on at the community TV show Voices from the Village, which we'll be playing some of the audio from on Sunday. And Steve's due to come into the studio on Sunday. Perhaps he will. Pat, perhaps you'll come back and the two of you can chat with each other. You have a list of questions for Steve.
Some of my fellow Facebookers have helped me get a list of questions for Steve, especially fellow Facebookers that once were on his Citizens for a Better Santa Cruz Facebook group.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. I don't really care about his Facebook determinations. I mean, he can be the grand autocrat all he wants on his own web page. The question is, as a city council person, what kinds of positions is he taking? How have they shifted and so forth? Those are going to be my concerns.
Well, our question is...
Why don't you bring it up on Sunday?
Well, just the leadership of how he moderates the group. Is that how he's going to be a city council member?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I do know that the Downtown Accountability Project was created through the Task Force on Public Safety last year, which was essentially had little to do with public safety and everything to do with what middle-class citizens on the West Side, some of them, and the Harvey West, and to some extent down on near the Emmeline Street, regarded as nuisance behavior. And the wholesale panic that they created around the issue of needles, which destroyed needle exchange in the city of Santa Cruz and has resulted in significant restrictions of needle exchange in the county, are exactly the opposite of public safety. They create public peril. And yet they do this through using the public safety label. And so I don't much have a lot of regard for this fireman and police worship that goes on. I think you should be fair. I think you should be accurate. I think you should acknowledge what individual police officers do and don't do, and what the police department itself does and doesn't do. But I've been very clear in saying that my general view is it ain't just a couple of rotten apples in the barrel. It is a rotten structure that essentially is racist, misogynist, homophobic, and classist to the max, and loves to conceal itself and gets lots of funding, whereas other services get starved. That's been my general feeling about the police services, in spite of the efforts of individual officers and even leaders in these departments to make changes there.
I just want to second that.
Yeah. And you know, I'm using all these fancy terms. My main concern has always been their abuses of poor people outside, and also their the ability to get away with killing people without accountability or hurting people without accountability. Seen most recently in the case, probably a lot of other recent things, the case of Richard Hardy, dropped face down to the sidewalk in handcuffs by Officer Vasquez. Still, as far as I know, no disciplinary consequences to that. And you know, we can get more recent with Officer Hernandez drawing a gun on a family at the Thanksgiving meal at the Salvation Army when they tried to take a plate of food out. And we've talked about that on the air at length, too. Let's hear some more from Nathaniel Kennedy, potential city council candidate. He didn't announce it there, but he certainly sounds like he's maybe thinking about that. We have a caller, though, first, and... Or we did have a caller. It looks like the caller stopped. Caller, do you want to call? We'll give you 5 seconds to make up your mind if you want to call back. Okay, back to Nathaniel Kennedy.
We need to help people with finding housing and jobs. The city of Santa Cruz is doing a better job than many other cities, but it still isn't enough. It's the classic catch-22. You can't find jobs when you don't have a home and the ability to stay clean, meaning both shower, bath, laundry, and as well as keeping off drugs. And you can't find a home because you don't have an income from your jobs. People frequently lose one than the other. I think the majority of people can pull themselves up by their bootstraps, but they still need some help. For example, loans to cover first, last deposit, etc., for moving into a place they found. We also need more job and house hunting resources, places we can provide computers and job and housing leads to the public as a whole. 3. Public restrooms in Santa Cruz. There is a drastic lack of them. Yeah, there are some at the Locust Street and Front Street parking garages and at the bus metro, to name a few. The big problem right now is these restrooms are not open 24 hours. It only encourages people to just poop on the sidewalk right in front of the closed restroom. When you gotta go, you gotta go. What we need is portable potties placed all over the downtown area in parking lots, as was the case many years ago. In the interest of public safety, I think all the city restrooms and porta potties should all have biohazard needle drop boxes. Not to encourage drug use, but to protect the public from disease and biohazards. All it takes is one prick from a discarded needle. 4, we need to
couple of comments here. No, it doesn't take one prick from a needle to cause an illness. It causes one prick to cause a hysterical reaction and a fear and create a lot of, concern. Your chances of getting any kind of a disease from a prick needle are very low, is my understanding, based on everything I've read. All the hysteria spread by Take Back Santa Cruz and the Clean Team and dutifully parroted by the Board of Supervisors and the Santa Cruz City Council, notwithstanding. Needle sharps containers in places around the city is an obvious way of reducing needle waste disposal that's inappropriate. And there used to be such a thing, for example, in the restrooms at the Loudoun Nelson Center, according to one of the workers there, whom I spoke with about a year ago. They were removed and put in the basement and not used. I don't know if they're back yet. I haven't seen sharps containers anywhere in the city other than at the, I guess there's two kiosks. There may be a sharps container in the, there is now a 24-hour porta-potty, we call it the Posner Pooper, at the corner of Front and Laurel Street. You had something you wanted to say, Pat?
Well, it might be a 24-hour porta-potty, unless you're in a wheelchair or disabled, then you just have to poop your pants or poop somewhere else.
Well, we don't need them gimps around, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, they're unsightly.
That's what we call hate speech on Santa Cruz Free Radio, by the way.
I'm a gimp.
Well, we don't need your kind around here. Stop trying to. You can pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, okay? All right, so more from Nathaniel Kennedy, but generally, Kennedy makes a lot of sense. I'd rather vote for him than any of the other candidates at the moment, if he's a candidate.
Liars, we need a new law requiring businesses to open their restrooms to the public as a whole instead of having customer-only restrooms. If a business doesn't want to provide public restrooms, they can always change it to an employee-only restroom. From Starbucks to Pizza My Heart, New Leaf, and others, I thank all the businesses who allow the public to use their facilities. I frequent those businesses often. At the same time, I don't give much business to some of the places that always insist that I buy something before I poop. I think we should let businesses charge up to 75 cents for any non-customer that wants to use that restroom. I do remember talking to a business owner who calculated their cost per use for the restroom, water, toilet paper, soap, etc., etc., was about 35 cents each time.
Thank you very much. And with that, we have one more speaker. Ma'am, did you want to speak to us on oral communication? You will be our last speaker then. You'll be next. Good afternoon.
Hello. Bruce Walker. I just want to clarify, I do not think fireworks are environmentally friendly, but people love them. I come to talk to you about Seabright Beach and the 4th of July.
He's going to talk to you about that, but and we're going to run out of time shortly on this show. But one of the things that was passed after oral communications at the evening session of the city council meeting two nights ago was a three-day citywide triple fine zone between, I guess, midnight July 3rd and midnight July 6th. That is to say, throughout July 4th, July 5th, and July 6th, for a number of infractions, including open container and graffiti, or not even graffiti, so-called defacing the sidewalk, which is the phrase used to describe, for example, people who write political slogans or draw hopscotch patterns on the sidewalk in erasable chalk sold downtown called Sidewalk Chalk at the Palace Arts Stationery Store. And I was actually reviewing some of the newspaper articles. Actually, I ran into them. I haven't reviewed them. But there was a controversy created when police began to arrest people for writing on the sidewalk. They were trying to show the restricted zones that would happen in 2002 if the six-foot setbacks were extended to 14 feet, as happened for sitting and spare changing, and to 10 feet for display devices. And Becky Johnson was arrested and held on $1,000 bail for being a part of this movement. And I think that charge was eventually dropped, but she was found guilty of defacing the sidewalk at one point for writing with erasable chalk. We have a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Hello? Going once. Going twice. Hey, call again. So let's hear some more of this, of Bruce Walker. Bruce spoke, of course, before this item came up on the agenda. I think it was the last item of the evening on the evening agenda, which was, again, this unusual process. I mean, we've had a situation where, in the past, the police department has been able to persuade the city council with no particularly great amount of effort to declare triple fine zones for a number of things, including open container, which means if you're poor and you drink a beer, you face a huge fine, whereas if you're rich, you just have to pay an overpriced beer price at a sidewalk cafe. But during you know, holiday celebrations where people massed downtown, there was also concern about traffic and parking and so forth. And there were some legitimate concerns that suggested, you know, you don't want cars to block this and block that. And so they had used to have a one-day-long triple fine zone for mostly parking infractions and also some other infractions as well, including, I think, the class-based attack on open containers. Although I can understand the attempt to control alcohol use, being not only a deadly drug, but also one that produces a lot of violence. But it's also a celebratory drug in American tradition as well. But in Halloween, on New Year's, and the 4th of July were the three times that they set up these triple fine zones. Well, it was last year or the year before they created an ongoing law. In the past, they would have to create a special triple fine zone law when it came up on those particular days and would come up for debate. And there were sometimes city council members who said no, or I wonder about this. Or last year, they discriminated against Hispanics. I saw that. I got reports of that happening. That created quite a hubbub when former council member Tony Madrigal made that claim. And Madrigal is no great champion of the poor or even of Hispanics, even though he was Hispanic himself. He was a good old boy, but he did get some reports that kind of concerned him. And he mentioned it in passing, at which point every council member denounced him. And actually, not only denounced him from the podium, they got up, they walked around to the public comment, and they made public comment against this council member. The idea that our police department would be racist is simply unthinkable to these folks. In any case, this year, well, they passed a law a couple years ago that set in made it possible to more quickly create these zones, although still has to be a resolution, I think. And the resolution then came up this year. It wasn't just for 24 hours. It was for 3 days. And it wasn't just for 3 days downtown, which is what it usually is in the high-impact zone. It was for citywide, all over town. So between July 4th and July 6th, watch out. I'll be talking more about this on Sunday and giving you the specific ordinances that you will pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars if cops ticket you for them. So let's hear some more from this guy, Bruce, who I've never heard of before. I don't know who he is, but he's a person who raises the obvious point. You're driving people away from the beaches and set up these massive checkpoints, and which were mentioned in today's Sentinel, if you've looked at the paper, where they have this huge police state activity on July 4th. But the purpose of that scene, what people do if they don't show no fireworks on the beach, they shoot them off in the woods. They shoot them off in the residential areas. It's a form of kind of ingrained, it seems to me like stupidity of a really profound kind, which may be more related to the police, a feeling that they got to do some controlling activities, and you can't really control people in the neighborhoods. because that's, you know, you have to walk onto their private property. But you certainly can stop them from going to public property on the beaches. And, you know, maybe I'm just shooting a little wild here. Maybe I'm reaching a little far, but I wonder what the motivation here is. Now, there is the claim that it's a drought this year, and so that there is a higher fire hazard than usual, perhaps. If so, I would think you would want to drive people to the beaches and give them special tickets and say, here, have some fireworks on the beach. And you would be, if you want to search people going into the woods with fireworks, I suppose, though I wouldn't regard that as appropriate either, really. But you would at least keep an eye out for them and say, hey, you know, shoot off those fireworks, you're going to have a lot of trouble, or you're possessing illegal fireworks or whatever. I should say at this point that when I was a youth, I was put on social probation in my school for bringing fireworks back from Mexico. So and there you have it, Confessions of the Norse. Let's hear some more from the City Council's oral communications. Don't you wish you were there?
To the Seabright neighborhood in the beautiful city of Santa Cruz years ago, and the 4th of July was approaching, and I kept hearing about the show on the beach. I waited with anticipation and was not disappointed. I talked with a police officer that night and was told, quote, this is the best show around, unquote. It was amazing. What also amazed me was that I went to the beach on July 5th with my garbage bags and found a very clean beach. It had already been picked up. Some local residents told me that they figured the people the night before had given them quite a show and it was the least they could do. This happens every year. I talked with a couple of city workers about the night of the 4th, and they told me that the city of Santa Cruz stopped doing their fireworks show because the fireworks on Seabright Beach. It was quite a show. The next year in the papers was talk about really cracking down on the people who set off the fireworks. There would be heavy-duty fines placed on them. The night of the 4th came and people gathered on the beach and on the cliffs overlooking the beach. I watched with anticipation. The state trucks lined up on the east side of Seabright and started moving towards the groups on the beach. They started to deal with one group. I heard a woman from the cliffs boo. We all started booing loudly. The state truck stopped and let the show go on. This was a very we the people moment, since this is what this day is about, the celebration of our nation's freedom from government suppression. We the people did not like what we were seeing and stopped it. The fireworks show on Seabright Beach has been suppressed more and more year after year. This scares me. I have observed each year more and more fireworks in our neighborhood dangerously being shot off. In my opinion, and other residents of the neighborhood think that it is much safer to allow fireworks on the beach. These people love their fireworks and will shoot them off. I am scared for our neighborhood and others. Please stop the hypocritical suppression of fireworks on the beach. Please talk with the State Parks Department and see what kind of resolution can be found. I thank you for your time. Thank you.
And, of course, the issue of these triple fine zones came up a couple hours later. I wasn't watching at that time or listening, but I talked to Councilmember Posner later, and I learned that he joined unanimously in voting for this expansion of the triple fine zone citywide for 3 days. And he said he had some concerns about it, but he didn't want to. He wanted to pick his battles, as he put it. He didn't want to antagonize the other council members by taking what I thought would be obvious to me would be a sensible and reasonable position against expanding police state activities here in actually a counterproductive and dangerous way. And I tried to point out, I haven't really pointed out this to him, but I probably will. Somebody like Pamela Comstock is not afraid to go to be in the minority and vote, be the one vote against an item. She's done this on a number of occasions. And partially this may be because she feels she has the backing of independent groups. But she votes against the mayor, Lynn Robinson, when she feels it's appropriate. She at least has a kind of a, what I would call in a way, a naive determination to express what she feels is right. I don't agree with her on most issues, but I respect that she has that determination. What is lacking on the left, whether it's Lane or Posner or any of the other people who have been on city council for the last decade and a half, generally, is the determination to stand alone if necessary and, in essence, to lead by being a part of the moral compass of our community, or being one of the moral compasses. And that's what the issue is going to be when I have Steve Plaich in the studio, who, you know, takes that role, or I've simply put him in that role in my own imagination. But we'll have Pat Colby firing from the side, and that'll be happening presumably at 11 o'clock on Sunday. But again, I can't promise, because Steve has canceled three times. So actually, I would say the first time he did so at my suggestion, because we had Tom Noddy here, and Tom was kind of took up a lot of the time himself, and Tom needs a lot of space to do his very colorful anecdotes. So that's about it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. We'll be playing the end of this as Uncle Dennis sets up.